an old quick Swedish
hello
name.
And you're good to go. Welcome to the show, Larry Swanson. And I put a little French accent in there. How does that sound?
That sounded great. That's the main reason I came on the show, is I wanted to have my name sung. So, okay, we're good. I can wrap it up now.
Brilliant. That was the 32nd episode on Branded Search and Beyond with Jason Barnard and Larry Swanson. So we're going to be talking about leveraging omnichannel content design into digital marketing. For me, omnichannel content design and digital marketing are the same thing. Am I wrong?
That's a great question. I would think the way I look at it, like I'm sort of a hybrid content strategist and information architect and omnichannel service designer. And to me, so this omnichannel content design that I do, it serves many more channels besides marketing as well. So I would argue that it's like, it's more not like all encompassing. It's just like a different beast. And one of those omnichannels that I'm concerned with is all the marketing channels.
Ooh, well, that's interesting, because I was just thinking about marketing. So omnichannel goes beyond just marketing, which is the huge question we're going to be answering. But first, I have to show you brand set.
Oh.
And this is what I really found interesting, is I took your bio and I pushed it into CaliCube Pro, analyzed it. It thought that your bio was all about, hang on, what was it? Word nerd. So it thought word nerd was this thing that the whole thing was about. And it saw Larry Swanson about seventh down the list, links through to a neuroscientist with your photo. That's nuts.
It is. I've been fighting with that guy for years. I kind of gave up because he's not fighting. I mean, I haven't met him. And what's funny is my sister is also a brain scientist. So there's probably all kinds of opportunities for conflation in there. Not that I gave up. It's like he's an academic and he's got all these papers and citations and he's extremely well known. So I've kind of not given up, but maybe I should consult with you about branding Larry Swanson.
Oh, definitely. Yep. We can help you with that. But what struck me as interesting is, number one, it's confused your photo with him. So your sister now explains that confusion, which is super interesting. And that's part of what we do at CaliCube, is dig into why does the machine not understand? And there is a huge piece of information I wouldn't have found for myself. And we need to understand that to sort out the machine's understanding. And number two is, he's famous in his field, but he's not famous, notable in a wider sense. But he has a Wikipedia page because he's important in his field. You are potentially more famous and more probable and potentially the dominant entity and the dominant interpretation of Larry Swanson, which is where we could help you. Is I think you are, with what you have, more notable and famous than he is, more probable than he is. And then it's a question for amplifying what you have, because what he has is Google Scholar, Wikipedia, and those sources that Google truly relies on that are going to get weaker and weaker as we move forwards, which makes your future path absolutely brilliant. If anybody wants to look into this and follow how we do all this stuff, get on board with the CaliCube newsletter, where you'll learn how to educate Google about things like this. There's a URL, calicube.com/newsletter, where you can sign up. I love this stuff, and I can talk about it all day, but we're not here for that. You are listening to Branded Search and Beyond with Jason Barnard. Now, back to the show. We're here to talk about omnichannel content design, digital marketing, and how you can bring the two together. Now, you said content marketing isn't, or digital marketing, sorry, isn't the focus of omnichannel. It's just one thing.
Well, yeah, if you look, and this all goes, it's kind of like, I'll tell a quick story about why I got out of SEO 15 years ago, because Google said, they were looking at pogo sticking and behaviors like that and saying, like, you know, we're just going to be interested in serving users as best we can. And going forward, and I was like, well, I've been doing SEO. I had been doing SEO since 96 at that point. I was like, yeah, I've had a good run. Let's go see what the next thing is. But I also more seriously had begun identifying more and more as a UX practitioner and designer. And so that was just the point at which I was like, no, I'm a customer focused, user centric person. I'd belong more in the UX field than in the marketing field. Not that there are plenty of, you know, user-centered, human-centered design folks in the marketing field, but for me, it was just like a logical kind of growth out of what I had been doing with SEO. Like the thing I always liked about SEO is that you had to be in your customer's head, you know, to do it right. Like it was the most user-centric form of marketing there ever was. And nowadays more, I'm more as an omnichannel service designer, I'm more concerned with this, that end user and truly meeting them on the journey where they're at. And that journey has nothing to do with my brand or your brand or the products we sell or anything else. They just need like art on the wall. So they need a picture and then they need a hole in the wall. And so they go to the store to buy a drill, you know, that whole story, that kind of thing. And so I'm more concerned with where are you at in your journey? How can I help you with content?
Right. No, sorry. What I loved about what you just said, and it inspired me in my little brain to think about SEO is all about when somebody's actively looking for something, whereas marketing is about standing where your audience is looking, even though they don't necessarily know that they're looking.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that was, I can't remember, when did Google first start talking about intent, you know, like searcher intent? I think it was around that same time. And, you know, and this is where my personal professional transition over the years, I began my career in book publishing and publishing, and then I kind of went into marketing from there. So I was always kind of like pushy. You know, I said, hey, I've got this brilliant book you should read, or hey, I've got this brilliant marketing message you should listen to. And I did have good stuff. And it was, you know, in fairness to people who still practice that way and who did what we did back then, you always did audience analysis and you spent a lot of time out in the world. You knew what was going on. It's not like we were idiots in the woods, you know, but just that shift in focus from pushing, you know, with a publishing mentality to like addressing user, being from a user-centric perspective, addressing the need of a person. The artifacts that you deliver, the communication that you do might look very similar, but I think that nuance of like coming at it from a customer focused perspective, that explains my whole transition over the last 15 years.
Well, I have another point to make, which is understanding the audience is really difficult. And we struggle as companies. We can look at what our sales team are hearing, what our support team are hearing. We can do market studies. Isn't the easiest thing just to ask Google?
Well, now you can ask ChatGPT, to what you're just saying, you know, because, and actually both are good sources of information about that. You know, Google with their about their knowledge graph, that's how you make your living. You know, their knowledge
graph. That's all I ever talk about is what you were about to say.
I wasn't going to say that. Would you just shut up? No. But seriously, between the two of them, it sort of gets at like the notion of, you know, this recent practice in generative AI around retrieval augmented generation, where you augment a search by referring to a knowledge source. It kind of like you put the two of them together. That's kind of what it is. Google has a knowledge graph, an ontologically backed understanding of the world, and that they can, and that's based on queries that retrieve information from that knowledge graph. LLMs are retrieving information from a stochastic prediction machine. You put the two of those together, it's like maybe only 1 or 2% of the way there, but it's starting to get at what actually human intelligence is about.
Oh, right. Sorry. And we're not talking about the topic at all, but they're 1 to 2% of the way there. And that's hugely interesting because people assume that LLMs and knowledge graphs are talking to each other and they're not. Can you explain that? Because I think that needs to be understood.
Well, I think, you know, I'm not a computer scientist or data scientist or anything, but I hang around with them a lot. And I just this morning listened again to Dean Alamang and Juan Cicada's report of their research around augmenting, you know, it was basically a RAG, retrieval augmented generation thing, where they compared the performance of single shot queries in an LLM, asking just simple questions, using both with and without retrieval augmented augmented generation of the results. And they show when you consult a knowledgeable source, like a database, or it doesn't have to be a knowledge graph, it can be any data source. I think theirs was in particular was looking at a ontologically driven knowledge graph versus like a relational database. Basically, the point was that a knowledge graph is better at retrieving stuff because it has, and this gets into the capabilities of LLMs, that they are pretty smart and can kind of, they're quite good at writing code. But they're sort of like at the level of like maybe a beginning to intermediate coder. When you get into the like complicated SQL queries and stuff, they kind of fizzle. And so anyhow, that was this experiment they did that just showed that basically if you put knowledge in, you know, it's like a Reese's cup, you know, peanut butter and chocolate, and you get, you know, delight.
I don't know what that means, but that's fine.
Okay.
But knowledge-based knowledge graph. What I like there with what you've just said is that an LLM can talk to a knowledge base very easily because the knowledge base is organized in a human kind of manner. The knowledge graph is more complex because the two aren't talking, because a knowledge graph is kind of independent thought and is able to extrapolate and think to a certain extent for itself. Is that a fair assessment?
I don't know if they can think for itself, but a knowledge graph, especially one that's written, and that's the thing, knowledge graph, it's a pretty fuzzy definition of exactly what a knowledge graph is. When I say knowledge graph, I'm talking about an RDF-based thing where the ontology is described in a language like OWL or RDFS, you know, that's like a precise language to, and anyhow, what that language does is it describes in terms that are both human and machine readable. Mm. Like an ontology is in human, like schema.org is probably the ontology that's most familiar to your listeners. That's an ontology that describes a lot of stuff in the world. And it, by having that ontological understanding mapped to data in, you know, to instances that share the concepts and the relationships that are defined in that ontology, that's just like that I would argue that that's way more powerful than a knowledge. I think most knowledge bases are things like wikis and things like that, which are sometimes semi-structured. They're not always as precisely structured as like a knowledge graph. And that's why I specify an RDF-based knowledge graph, because RDF triples are the foundation, the data storage mechanism for a knowledge graph. And that's where that's where the power of it comes in, that ability to infer like things that would take a room full of SQL programmers a week to write. You know, you can do it, this gets back to your question about how intelligent they are,
right?
That somebody who can write a good Sparkle query can generate results that draw inferences across data all through that knowledge base.
Okay, sorry, you've just said the word that I didn't have, which was inferences, and I was thinking of extrapolation, I was thinking of intelligence, but it's inferring information from information that already exists, which
exactly.
is where a knowledge graph can excel.
Yeah, yeah, and the beauty of a knowledge graph, and I think, I don't know, you know, like I said, I'm not technical about this stuff at all, but I think the thing that makes
it
so...
Can I make a point? You're already more technical than I am, so...
Okay, I'll take that, because I've always been like... I hang out, half my friends are engineers. I can talk to them and understand words that come out of their mouth, but I can't write code and stuff. But anyhow, it's that ability. It's that the fact that the machine is, you can read what a human created, like in the same, using the same syntax and understanding of the concepts. That's what permits that inference. I don't know. Again, it's like a kind of artificial intelligence. It's in the same, you know, it's just a different, a cousin of LLMs in that regard.
But that, for me, that's huge. You've just taught me something that's just changed my whole perception of what we're doing. Because what I see is search generative experience is an LLM that has search results, but it's got an LLM, it's got the search results, and it's got the knowledge base, that is the lookup table that Google uses for all its knowledge graphs, which means that it's using this simple lookup system for facts, but it's not using the knowledge graph, which would allow inference.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty, I don't know a huge amount about this, but I know that it's a pretty common use case that for knowledge graphs, to not do full-blown inference. Like I have a friend who runs, we talked about it on the podcast, so I can talk about this. She's the lead ontologist at IKEA, and they have a big knowledge graph that describes all their products. And I was like, I said, oh, so you're doing all this cool inference stuff. She goes, no, we're just, you know, ensconcing business rules in, you know, algorithmically and running, doing recommendations based on, you know, just the codification and understanding of subject matter expertise, you know, from interior designers and people like that. So there's, I think the real power of it, you know, things like applications like, you know, fraud detection and financial analysis and things like that. That's where I think that inference comes in. Like, hey, wait a minute, this company owns that company and that company owns that company, and these guys are depositing all this money in Switzerland. What's going on? That's the kind of inference that, but I think a lot of applications that draw on these knowledge graphs and knowledge bases are way less, they're not doing the fancy inference stuff.
Because, yeah, no, sorry, you make a very good point there, is this company owns that company, which is placing money here, there, and in other places. Therefore, I can infer that it's risky. And from a relational database, I would need my human intelligence to make that connection, whereas a knowledge graph can do it right off the bat.
Yeah. And I think that's because it's like it explicitly puts things in human terms, whereas like a lot of the connections between relational database, like tables, you know, it's like often a key, you know, the keys that tie things together that have no meaning associated with them, whereas everything in a knowledge graph has meaning. And that's what permits this stuff.
Right. Yeah. We have a huge relational database, which is CaliCube Pro. And it's got all these tables that are connected, and I understand it, and I was luckily able to explain it to Elisa, who now understands it, which means that my system of organization makes sense to her. But the actual foundational meaning of the IDs in each table is non-existent.
Yeah.
It's my brain that's connected it, whereas the knowledge graph would make that happen on its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where, I mean, that's just us learning to play with data differently, you know, to... and I haven't built a triple store like the typical RDF foundation, you know, of a knowledge graph. But you know, I'm dying. I've talked to people who use RDF implementations in content work, and that's super powerful.
Right. Ooh. And we're totally off topic, of course, which is kind of what happens on Branded Search and Beyond with Jason Barnard, which is me trying to get my stinger in there. I'm really now want to get back to omnichannel content design. What do you mean by omnichannel content design? Because that was where the conversation started.
Yeah, that kind of the
definition.
It kind of wraps up the like I said, that first of all, the customer centricity. As soon as you put that hat on, you realize that these are just people out in the world who might possibly buy your business, your service, or your product at some point. So they're on a journey that might include stops. They might be on their laptop at home. They might be at their desktop computer at work. They might have their phone, might have their Apple Watch. They might be talking to their refrigerator about what to order, you know, at the store. There's all these different channels by which they might be looking for information about your product or service. They just have a bunch of, you know, it's like my friend Nazar Bina describes the customer journeys as questions over time. It's more complex than that, but basically you're on a journey, and this is where the content part of it comes in.
But sorry, to interrupt. Yeah. It's not all questions, and it's not all me looking. It might also be the company putting themselves in front of me at a moment when it makes sense to me. So
that's true.
When I do look, I want them.
Yeah, and I would argue that like the best of those kinds of messages are going to be driven by a customer journey map and an understanding of that customer journey. You know, that would be, and that's just like the advancement of that audience analysis I was doing 30 years ago when I started in publishing and marketing, you know, back in those days. I think that's still, yeah, it's still completely true. And you're right. I think a huge amount of the content in the world right now is like that. You know, look at any social media feed or, you know, and we're all, it's sort of like collateral interactions. You know, we're out there on our journeys kind of looking for stuff, and all this other stuff might show up in our face. And good marketers are going like, oh, if he's over here doing this, if I put this message here, they're likely to see it.
And so are you saying that I can't jump in front of somebody and convince them they want something they didn't know they wanted? What I can do is present myself tangentially to something they're already looking for.
Yeah, that's what I would argue. I think, and that goes back to, you know, 25 years ago, Seth Godin's idea about permission-based marketing. Like, can I have your permission to show you this message? You know, would you like to hear from me? But then I think more recently it comes to this this journey-focused omnichannel strategy approach that is like that has the bigger picture of all that. That like, yeah, we're out there, we're looking at marketing messages, we're looking at all kinds of things, but it's driven by, again, it's just a more genuinely customer-focused twist on that journey, you know, journey and audience analysis and discovery. Like you really, it's back to why I liked SEO so much when I discovered it almost 30 years ago, is that it's so user-focused. You got to get inside their head to do it. And omnichannel, content strategy is very much the same thing. It's like, where are you at? How can I help you? And service design is a much bigger discipline than I do it as part of my job. But the way content fits into the service design, which is the main discipline that I think that addresses omnichannel needs, is that, okay, where are you at? What do you need? How can I help you? Oh, here's some content that can help you with that. Here's the information you need to help you at this point in time.
So you're creating the content or designing the content to fit with the user need wherever they happen to be in the funnel. What do you mean by omnichannel? Can you define that really clearly?
Yeah, omnichannel is like, so multi-channel would be delivering to, you know, and this has been around for a long time, you know, that you can create the same content. You have a CMS or a database or something that you can spit out a newsletter and a website and social media feed information. That's multi-channel.
And that's multi-channel.
That's multi-channel. Omnichannel is like adding a layer on top of that that realizes that the customer doesn't care which of those channels they're getting the information from. Literally, they don't care. They're just like, they're in the store. They want to look it up on the kiosk. They're on their laptop. They want to, you know, do some detailed side-by-side table comparison. They're on their phone in the store. They just want like a quick description. So omnichannel is...
So it's being everywhere for everyone who might need you.
Yeah, it's that omnipresent content strategy.
Now it seems so simple. Thank you so much. Because I just thought omnichannel meant well-branded multi-channel, but it doesn't. Multi-channel is pushing out the same content on multiple channels. Omnichannel is being omnipresent. And I would imagine consistent branding is a huge part of that.
Huge. And that's one of the, you know, that's a generic benefit of good content strategy, like good enterprise content strategy, you know, that is concerned. So many of the concerns of like the kind of enterprise scale content strategy I do are directly related to branding, you know, like considerations of voice and tone and style, consistency, just all those things that customers expect, you know, that build the perception that they have. Like, I don't know how you describe branding. I loved this definition I heard many years ago where somebody said the branding is what they say about you when you've left the room. You know, the impression that you leave with people and having like all those things that a good enterprise, and this is not just like pertaining to individual content artifacts. It's also building, you know, designing and building systems that support the delivery of that stuff.
Right. Which is brilliant. And you could actually now look at it as, your branding is what Google and ChatGPT say about you when somebody asks them.
Exactly. There's sort of a proxy for that, what people are saying about you when you've left the room. That's a great way.
What they're doing is looking at what people say about you and what you say about yourself and creating a balanced overview of that. So branding is what these huge machines say about you, and what we do at Calicube is educate the machines. And in fact, right now, we're in a position where we can heavily influence what they say. We can almost control it. That isn't going to last, is it?
I don't know. You know, when it comes to anything about SEO and this whole world, I've every prediction I've ever made has been wrong. So I just don't predict.
In that case, what I will do is ask another question, which comes back to omnichannel marketing. Somebody on the show said to me, and I can't remember her name, I'm really sorry, that 90% of the people you can sell to do not want your product today, but will want it in the future. So you need to make sure that you're in front of them the day they need that product. You need to make sure they know who you are now, so that they then either look you up or react positively when they see you when they're researching that need.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I love that perspective because it kind of gets at a couple things. One, the intent of branding over like campaign-driven marketing messaging kind of stuff, that lingering impression that it has. But it also ties in with this notion that we have in the content modeling and content design world of future-proofing your content. You know, that like it's got to be ready. You know, it's like for that, for both the current need, what you know you need now, but also unanticipated needs in the future. And that person, their journey may be modified a little bit or something, but if you have like nicely structured, semantically tagged content, you know, that is findable, if that same person shows up later, you know, that's another way that really well-designed content can support branding, is that it's got a memory and it's anticipated your possible future needs.
Oh yeah, and then brand is the ultimate memory thing. And then the content supports that. But what I'm now thinking, can we not just create the great content that's incredibly well branded, feed it to Google, ChatGPT, and the other generative AI machines, and let them get on with figuring out when somebody actually needs us?
This is happening right now. What you just is probably half of business activity in the world right now. But I think, you know, when you look at the capabilities, especially just LLMs, you know, just the ChatGPT and their ilk, the stochastic prediction machines, they make really compelling, really good content. But it's just based on their knowledge of the current world and looking and guessing what people are likely to say in that kind of situation. When you're coming to like branded content, like if you're like the classic example of is some, you know, any industry that's subject to compliance, like financial or pharmacy or pharmaceuticals or things like that. Would you trust the current generation of generative AI tools to talk about you, you know, or to add it, you know, or can they even at a compliance with the FDA or whatever agency is looking over this, can they create content that would comply with your legal requirements as a business entity, you know, about like drug side effects or investment risk or something like that? So I think that's just one edge case that shows like, yeah, probably not ready for prime time at this point.
No. Well, 100%. But that brings a couple of questions. Number one, you don't really have the choice. Number two is your aim as a brand is to be the most probable solution to a problem. And that is probably the key to the future of generative AI in search, assistive, and answer engines, is make your brand the most probable solution.
I love that perspective. I'm going to tuck that away and think about that in my strategy work, because I think you're right that like, It's sort of like a chicken and egg dilemma. Like because it's here, now we have to pay attention to it and respond to it and do behave in a way. It's like the machine.
I'm not sure if I've lost Larry.
Sorry.
No, you're back. Oh, brilliant.
Sorry about that. Yeah, no, I think I was just saying that it's like that mechanism is just like SEO, the whole field of SEO, which was like, people need to show up in Google search results. We need to figure out what's going on and behave in a way that makes sure whether we show up in those SERPs. And I think you're kind of scaring me a little bit with that question, because now I'm thinking like, oh, great. Now do we have to like anticipate the vectorizability of every bit of content we create that'll show up in a way that makes Google predict that is the likely brand that's going to serve this need? That's an interesting perspective.
Well, I think what we're looking at is understanding who you are, what you offer, the confidence in the understanding. And I think confidence in understanding is something that people underestimate. So does the machine understand? Is it confident in that understanding? Does it see you as a credible solution? And are you the most probably adequate solution to whatever problem the person has? And if you can solve those problems, the machine will always recommend you over and above the competition. That's my conclusion. That was brilliant. Thank you, Larry. You took us off on multiple places. And now I want you to answer in 1 minute this question. How does omnichannel content design help with branded search?
Well, specifically with branded search, like one of the foundations of content design is building your content in a way that it's structured in a way that it can be used in a variety of places, which omnichannel necessitates that. You've got to have your content ready for presentation in a variety of contexts and channels and settings. The design of it is accompanied by a metadata strategy that tags your content in a way that it's understandable. That's typically used for things like recommendations and personalization and stuff like that. But that semantic meaning that's attached to it aligns perfectly with the knowledge graph awareness and knowledge and work that you do at CaliCube around understanding what a brand is, or not just understanding, but helping Google understand what your brand is. And so I think, well-designed content that has the metadata that is driven by omnichannel, that's gonna help your branded search a lot.
Brilliant. That makes total sense. And this is one of the geekier 60-second how does X help with branded search that we've had. That was absolutely brilliant, Larry. I was totally inspired. I love talking to you. You're one of the smart people I know who inspires thought in my mind and gives me information that I didn't previously have, and I greatly appreciate it. Now we're going to introduce somebody who did the same thing at Capshow Festival in Orlando a few weeks ago, Kevin Chemidlin, building effective landing pages and newsletters. This is something we want to do, and that's why we're now pushing the CaliCube newsletter harder and harder and harder, because Kevin told me to do it. Could you possibly pass the baton?
I'm delighted to learn about Kevin Chemidlin because I'm in a similar place. I'm kind of trying to update my newsletter and game and revamp my websites in a way that might include landing pages. So happy to pass the baton. I don't know how that works, but there's my baton going over to Kevin.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Larry. Kevin is brilliant. Please join us next week. Larry, that was absolutely stunning. You get the outro song. A quick goodbye to end the show. Thank you, Larry.
Thanks so much, Jason.
CaliCube. It's all about your brand SERP.